Australia's military history is more than just a collection of dates and the locations of war-ravaged battlefields. It is the stories of service and sacrifice of those who have answered the call of their country of birth or adoption and the enduring legacy they have created. Join me as we look into one of those stories. I'm your host, Ross Manuel, and welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, a Doc Network podcast. Now let's get started. G'day friends, and welcome to episode 54 of the podcast, and this is it folks, the conclusion of our involvement in History Talk's Shipwreck Summer. It's been quite a journey to get here, and it's been a lot of fun to do an ongoing series like this, so I must give a huge shout out to Melissa Ratliff of God's Favourites History Podcast, who came up with the idea. Now with all that out of the way, let's secure our hatches and moorings and get steady for the finale of Shipwreck Summer. Henry Hugh Gordon Dacre Stoker was born on the 2nd of February 1885 in Dublin, Ireland, the fourth of six children to Dr. William Stoker and Jane Martin Ross Stoker. Known as Dacre Stoker to his family, namely due to the insistence of his close relative Bram Stoker, the creator of Dracula, while at school, Stoker was considered an average student academically, but excelled at sport, in particular tennis and rugby. Now, sport seems to be a major factor for the Stoker family, with an uncle, Dr. Francis Stoker, a two-time Wimbledon winner and an international Irish rugby union player. At the age of 12, Stoker was sent to England to attend a school that specialised in training boys who were passing the entrance exam for the Royal Naval College. With no familial connection to the sea, his decision to join the Navy seems to have come from a conversation that he had with a school friend, which was enough to convince him to join. His opinion of the school, however, was not the best. Quote, "Life at the new school was misery. The strange English boys seemed so queerly stolid and placid, except when poking fun at me and my Bruges. The headmaster thought I was being impertinent when I was only meant to be friendly. The matron laughed at my wardrobe, collected Irish fashion, in bits and pieces from any odd place. I made my first acquaintance with the demon homesickness. Work got its first hold on me, and I was helplessly and gloriously miserable. The headmaster reported that I had little chance of getting through the examination, which again riled my Irish ire, and I persuaded my father to let me try, whereat, to the astonishment of everyone, myself included, I was successful in my first attempt and blossomed out in all the glory of one of His Majesty's naval cadets." Unquote. 3 weeks before his 15th birthday, as was the custom at the time, Stoker joined the Royal Navy, and much like Thomas Besant before him, he was accepted in the Britannia Naval College at Dartmouth on the 15th of January 1900, and was billeted aboard the same 76.8-metre long, first X-rate three-decker line of battleship, HMS Britannia. As Besant was steaming around in the Boxer Rebellion as part of the China Squadron, Stoker completed his initial training on the 17th of June 1900 and was assigned to the Majestic-class pre-dreadnought battleship, HMS Jupiter, then assigned to the Channel Fleet. On the 30th of May 1901, Stoker received his midshipman certificate, and then on the 23rd of August 1901, take his turn assigned to HMS Vivid, before posting to the formidable class battleship HMS Implacable on the 8th of September 1901 for service in the Mediterranean. 3 years later, on the 30th of July 1904, Stoker would be promoted to sub-lieutenant and attended the Royal Naval College for his lieutenant certification on the 4th of October. While there, he performed well, receiving first-class passes in seamanship, second-class passes in pilotage, gunnery and torpedo, and third-class in navigation. This is interesting, as this will play a factor in his future. Stoker took a different route to HMS Thames and the submarine service to Besant, serving first aboard the armoured cruiser HMS Drake. Now, due to the danger associated with the new submarine technology, officers in ratings who agreed to serve aboard them were promised better pay for their time, which was something that convinced Stoker to volunteer for the service in 1905, though it wouldn't be until 1906 when he was accepted. He was assigned to a succession of submarine tenders, His Majesty's ships Hazard and Mercury, for, quote, "additional instructions in submarines," unquote, before he started training on the 31st of October 1906 at HMS Thames. While there, he would make lieutenant in the 1906 King's New Year's Honours List. While in the silent service, Stoker revelled in the freedom it offered, which was beneficial on the 19th of December 1908 in Exeter, when he would marry Olive Joan Violet Gwendolyn Leacock. Almost as if a wedding present from the Royal Navy, in January 1909, Stoker was appointed to the submarine tender HMS Onyx to command submarine HMS A-10. That year, the Stokers would also welcome their first child, a daughter, Hope Esme Wilmot Stoker. The following year, he returned to HMS 4th to command HMS B-8. While in command of B-8, the Stokers would welcome their second daughter, Joan Eileen Dolores Stoker, in 1911, as the boat steamed as part of a three-boat flotilla to Gibraltar as part of the Overseas Flotilla and to open the submarine base station there. In October 1913, Stoker was appointed to, quote, Submarine AE-2 in command, unquote, and joined the Royal Australian Navy, volunteering for a three-year stint. One of the reasons I've routinely found that explained why he agreed to the appointment was that, ever the avid sportsman, he had heard a rumour that there was a wealthy sportsman in Sydney who was paying a polo sponsorship for anyone who joined the Navy. And after this assignment, Stoker went to Barrow in Furness to supervise the construction and carry out sea trials of AE-2. In my research, I haven't been able to find any information about the relationship between Besant and Stoker, if there was one, if they'd known each other prior to their appointments as in command of Australia's own two wartime submarines, or whether or not they had any animosity to their positions within the hierarchy. However, they did get to know each other when the two boats were commissioned on the 28th of February 1914 before departing for Sydney on the 2nd of March from Portsmouth. As mentioned in the last episode, the transit between the two ports was eventful for both boats, in particular for AE-2. 4 days out of Portsmouth, a propeller blade fell off, requiring repairs in Gibraltar. After transiting the Suez Canal, the blade of the other propeller fell off, not far from Aden, which is now in Yemen. On this occasion, repairs were actually carried out at sea, with the assistance of HMS Eclipse. The submarine was trimmed down to the bows, and two anchors and cable from Eclipse were lowered over the front to bring the stern out of the water. With the assistance of divers, a replacement propeller was fitted, and the entire event took 2 days. Despite the stifling conditions, AE-2 continued the remainder of the 60-day, 13,000-kilometre journey more or less without issue. Save for the near miss while transiting the Lombok Strait when AE-1's rudder malfunctioned. Now this caused the tow wire that connected her to HMS Sydney to interfere with Sydney's rudder. While Stoker had managed to navigate his boat to avoid the potential collision, he did move AE-2 ahead of Sydney, which resulted in Sydney almost colliding with her. During the transit, the Stokers also welcomed their third child, another daughter, Iris O.P. Stoker. On AE-2's arrival in Sydney, the crew enjoyed the hospitality of the locals, and the Australians who served aboard her enjoyed the ability to reunite with friends and family. Now for Stoker, his family still in England, he in his own words, according to his biography, Straws in the Wind, he acted every bit the philanderer. Operating in social circles, none of the other submariners did, while the two boats underwent refit and repairs from the history-making journey. Now, since the last episode of the podcast, I have received a number of questions from the Army and Emu Brigade relating to subs, namely why they're called boats and how they're allowed to fly Jolly Rogers. Now, in regards to why subs are referred to as boats, there really isn't an established reason why, but the general consensus, according to the United States Naval Institute, is, quote, a boat is a watercraft that is small enough to be carried on board a larger one, and that larger one is a ship, unquote. Also, it is a ship if, quote, it has a permanent crew and commanding officer, unquote. If it has a part-time crew, as in the crew is assigned to a tender, then it's a boat. Now, technically, submarines are ships, but historically speaking, submarines were small and only manned when in use. As with Stoker, he was assigned to the submarine tenders to command the submarines, not the submarines themselves. In fact, AE-2 is the first submarine on his rather extensive service record that appears as his posting. Even though modern submarines are deployed for months at a time, and even AE-1 and AE-2 were deployed independently of their tender for the duration of their war, the old naming convention has stuck to this day. As for Jolly Rogers, it's a lot harder to nail down a complete reason. But, according to the National Museum for the Royal Navy, the Jolly Roger was flown when returning to port after a successful patrol. It would mark its achievements, ships sunk, U-boats sunk, ships damaged, clandestine insertions of shore parties, usage of the deck gun, if the boat had one, and serving as a navigational marker for an invasion force. Now, while the Admiralty has disapproved of the practice, they have done nothing to stop it, and the tradition continues to this day. At the outbreak of the First World War, AE-2 joined her sister and the tender HMAS Upolu as the Australian squadron steamed for Rabaul. Because of the focus relating to AE-1's disappearance, AE-2 doesn't get a mention in regard to his activities during this time. In fact, it barely gets mentioned in the official histories. However, the loss of her brother sailors aboard AE-1 would have been at the forefront of their minds as they remained on station for a further 3 weeks before they steamed to Suva on October 4. There, they served as part of a multinational force in response to German raids on the French Society Islands, and it was during this time that Stoker was asked by the Australian Naval Board for his opinion on the fate of AE-1, as mentioned in last episode. After 4 weeks fruitfully hunting for Admiral Count Maximilian von Spee and his German East Asiatic Squadron, word reached the Australian command that the German forces had been spotted off the Chilean coast, and this news coincided with AE-2 returning to Sydney on November 16 for maintenance. While the boat was in dock, news would reach Stoker of the Battle of the Falkland Islands between an overwhelmingly British force and the Asiatic Squadron, which resulted in von Spee's death and the destruction of German naval power in the Southern Hemisphere. According to Stoker, with the threat of Australian shipping now abated, he personally bailed up the Defence Minister, the West Australian Senator George Pearce, yes, the same man behind the events of the Emu War, behind the Speaker's chair of the House of Representatives, and talked him into sending AE-2 back to Europe to assist in the European War. Pearce was apparently convinced, and AE-2 slipped her moorings on the 19th of December from Sydney bound for Melbourne. She spent Christmas in the Great Australian Bight, then met up with the 2nd Australian Expeditionary Force in Albany to serve as her sole escort. Due to the actions of HMAS Sydney 1 against the German commerce raider SMS Emden with the 1st Australian convoy, there was no longer any serious need to provide escorts to the convoys. So for most of the journey from Albany, Western Australia to Colombo in modern-day Sri Lanka, AE-2 travelled under tow of transport SS Berrima. During this transit, Stoker would also be promoted to Lieutenant Commander. Stoker and AE-2 travelled with the convoy through the Suez Canal, arriving at Port Said on the 28th of January 1915. From there, the boat was transferred to the Mediterranean Fleet and tasked with steaming to the Aegean Sea to join the forces of the Dardanelles in February. AE-2 joined the fleet at the island of Tenedos and received orders to patrol the entrance of the Dardanelles as British, French, and Russian warships attempted to force the Straits as part of First Lord of the Admiralty Winston Churchill's plan to knock the Ottoman Empire out of the war. While AE-2 would join other Allied submarines as part of the 2nd Submarine Flotilla, the first to actually attempt to force the Dardanelles was HMS B-11 under the command of Lieutenant Commander Norman Holbrook on the 13th of December, while Stoker was still steaming for Melbourne. B-11 managed to navigate the lines of mines to sink the Ottoman battleship Mesudile in an action which garnered Holbrook the Victoria Cross, the first for a submariner. On an interesting side note, though, that Victoria Cross is actually in Australia, as at the time, the New South Wales Eastern Riverina town of Germantown actually changed their name to Holbrook in honour of his achievement. Holbrook donated these Victoria Cross and medal set to the town in thanks for this, and now currently sits in the First World War Gallery of the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. On the 15th of January, the first French attempt to force the Straits by submarine occurred when Saphir negotiated at a geographical location known as the Narrows, where the Straits were only about half a mile wide, which is also the most heavily mined stretch of the Dardanelles, passing 10 lines of mines before she unfortunately ran aground. The boat was lost, though its manner of sinking is still up to dispute. The British attempted the second passage with HMS E-15 on the 17th of April, but dived too deep and was caught in a current and ran aground. 7 crew were killed and the remainder taken prisoner, but as it had been beached, the Ottomans had claimed it as a trophy. That was until, of course, the British sank it after several attempts. From late February, the super dreadnoughts, such as Queen Elizabeth, began bombarding the Dardanelles forts, and it was from here that Besant's first sea posting, HMS Endymion, re-enters Australian military history, where it was one of the warships that was providing gunfire support for what would become the Gallipoli campaign. AE-2 started preparing in the hopes that she would get an attempt to force the passage, but alas, she ended up running afoul of the rocks outside of Mudros Harbour in Lemnos when returning from a patrol on the 17th of March. She was stuck for 3 hours, and while she got off safely, she had to go to Malta for hull repairs. While Stoker was fretting and champing at the bit in Malta, the first grand attacks on the forts of the Narrows was made by the battle fleet on the 18th of March, but failed, and 3 battleships were sunk by mines floated down the coast from Chanak, and this began a series of unsuccessful attempts by surface vessels to also force the Dardanelles, with the end result being to directly threaten Constantinople, the capital of the Ottoman Empire, in what is now modern-day Turkey, to force the Ottomans to ease their confrontation with the Russians. This was part of the issues that led to what would become the Gallipoli campaign. Now, I need to say it. While Winston Churchill was First Lord of the Admiralty, he was not involved in the amphibious operations of the campaign. The responsibility of that falls solely on the shoulders of First Sea Lord Admiral Sir John Fisher. According to Stoker, on the 23rd of April 1915, he was summoned by Commander Eastern Mediterranean Fleet, Vice Admiral John D. Roebuck, where he was ordered to proceed through the Dardanelles. If he was undiscovered, he was to, quote, run amok, unquote, and to attack shipping off the coast of Gallipoli. Watch the approaches and await further orders. If he was discovered, he was to attack any vessel in the vicinity of Chanak before heading to Gallipoli. Stoker, to his credit, had been studying in the weeks that he'd been attached to the Dardanelles force and had formed the opinion that despite the difficulties involved, an attempt to dive a submarine through the Dardanelles and into the Sea of Marmara held sufficient chance of success to justify the attempt being made. On the 24th of April, a broken hydroplane foiled AE-2's first attempt to force the straits, causing the boat to having to dive suddenly to avoid Turkish spotlights. Now, a hydroplane, is otherwise known as a diving plane, is the control surface that allows a boat to pitch up and down, which, considering what AE-2 was about to do, is an incredibly important piece of tech to fail right at that moment. After a few hours, the repairs had been completed, and Stoker was given a chance to try again. The following morning, the 25th of April, 1915, a date that will forever be enshrined in Australian history, Stoker took his tiny metal container and her crew into the jagged narrows and minefields of the Dardanelles, quote, at about 8 knots, unquote, as mentioned in Stoker's official report. He had been ordered to cause diversions to cover the landings at what would become Anzac Cove. To accomplish this, AE-2 stayed on the surface for as long as possible to both conserve battery power and to draw attention to the craft, even though it did make it a prime target for the Turkish forts. At 4:30 a.m, AE-2 was fired upon from a battery from the northern shoreline, which prompted Stoker to order the boat to dive. Quote, during the ensuing half hour or so, the scraping of wires against the vessel's side were almost continuous, and on two occasions something caught up forward and became loose and scraped away aft, unquote. Once they passed through the minefield, as described by Stoker's writings, AE-2 came up to periscope depth and was spotted by the Turkish forts and once again came under fire. Narrowly avoiding a Turkish destroyer, AE-2 fired a bow torpedo at the small Ottoman cruiser Peki Shevket, disabling it and allowing AE-2 to escape, but in doing so, she ran aground underneath Fort Anatoly Medjide. Though for Stoker and his crew, they were fortunate that they were too close to the fort to allow her guns to depress sufficiently far enough to hit them. Getting the boat free, AE-2 then, almost as a comedy of errors, became immediately grounded a second time, this time on the opposite side of the narrows, and again under the guns of another Turkish fort, this time Fort Derinburna. Stoker was able to refloat AE-2, but now he thought the boat was so badly damaged to fight, but, quote, as I considered my chief duty to prove the passage through the straits was possible, I decided to continue my course, unquote. From this point, AE-2 was pursued by Turkish warships and a pair of ferries that were dragging cables slung between them with an early form of depth charge, trawling for submarines. To counter this, AE-2 settled on the bottom of the Dardanelles and waited. This allowed them to narrowly evade their attempts to find them, and at this point in history, anti-submarine warfare comprised entirely of ramming the submarine, or engaging it when it was on the surface. One of the crew recorded in his diary, quote, during all this time, the captain remained extremely cool, for all depending on him at this stage, it was due to his coolness that I am now writing this account. Nobody knows what terrible strain it is on the nerves to undergo anything like this, especially the captain, as all depends on him, unquote. It wasn't until 9 p.m, or about 16 hours after entering the straits, that it was finally safe to surface to recharge batteries and replenish the fetid air that had been circulating through the boat. While they took a breath of fresh air, Stoker ordered his wireless telegraphist to signal their success to Admiral Robeck, though, due to the relative fragility in the technology, Stoker didn't receive a response to his report and didn't know if it had actually gotten through. His report did get through, though, and eventually found itself aboard HMS Queen Elizabeth and the desk of the commander of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, General Sir Ian Hamilton. It arrived at about the same time that he was deliberating on whether or not to withdraw the forces from Anzac, as a number of his commanders were calling for. Now, there is some speculation that Stoker's report that AE-2 had managed to reach Jannik, which resides opposite Gallipoli, as the impetus for Hamilton to overrule his commanders and to issue his now famous dig-in order, which follows, quote, your news is indeed serious, but there is nothing for it but to dig yourselves right in and stick it out. It would take at least 2 days to re-embark you, as Admiral Thresby will explain to you. Meanwhile, the Australian submarine has got up through the narrows and has torpedoed a gunboat at Jannik. P.S. You have got through the difficult business. Now you only have to dig, dig, dig until you are safe, unquote. Despite mentioning AE-2 in the orders, it is unclear if Stoker's success influenced Hamilton, or if he'd simply used it as justification to stay. Either way, there was an immediate morale boost to the troops on the peninsula, and AE-2 gained the moniker, the Silent Anzac. Whatever the effect of Stoker's signal had on the landings, he himself was in a difficult position. He couldn't be sure that the signal had even gotten through, and now he might be isolated far behind enemy lines with a major battle in progress. He had no deck gun on which to fire on Turkish shipping and only 6 torpedoes left, but he realized that the psychological effect of his presence would be considerable. While in posterity we know the signal had been received, and within 2 hours, a second submarine, E-14, had been ordered to repeat Stoker's fate, but at the time, Stoker had no knowledge of this. He ordered AE-2 to remain on the surface until dawn and engaged on the Turkish ship and missed, and then entered the Sea of Marmara at 9 a.m. on the 26th of April, and in doing so became the first Allied warship to achieve this. Over the next 2 days, AE-2 ran amok, engaging Turkish shipping with no success, and even at one point surfacing amongst a group of Turkish fishing boats. On the 29th of April, with fierce fighting going on just miles away from the Gallipoli Peninsula, Stoker returned to the straits, dived, then turned back into the Sea of Marmara, with his periscope breaking the surface to give the impression of a second submarine entering the sea. He shook off his pursuers yet again, fired, and narrowly missed hitting a Turkish gunboat. Down to the last of his torpedoes, Stoker planned to head for Constantinople and attack local shipping there. While the orders were being carried out, the watchman sighted another submarine. It was E-14. The commanding officer of that boat, Lieutenant Commander Edward Courtney Boyle, who was the senior officer, overruled Stoker and his wishes to engage Constantinople and ordered that the two boats rendezvous the next morning at Karabrunu Point. Unfortunately, this rendezvous never occurred. As AE-2 approached the designated location, at 10 a.m, Stoker observed a torpedo boat, the Sultan Hassar, and immediately dived. Half an hour later, for some unaccountable reason, AE-2 suddenly went bow up and broke the surface just 90 meters from Sultan Hassar, which opened fire. Stoker again attempted to dive, but the AE-2 was out of control and began to plunge into the depths, quote, deeper and deeper until she passed 30 meters. All eyes were on the boat's sides, waiting for them to cave in, unquote. Engineers managed to repair the controls and raise the boat. However, quote, within seconds, the engine room was hit and holed in three places, unquote. It was at this point that Stoker realized that his boat was not long for this world and ordered his crew to abandon ship and prepared the boat to be scuttled. Stoker's second command, Lieutenant Jeffrey Haggard, was keen to fight on, but without a deck gun or the ability to dive, it would have caused unnecessary slaughter of the crew. So Stoker ordered a white tablecloth to be waved at the Turkish warships, indicating he was surrendering. But in reality, this was to give them a ceasefire to allow his men to abandon ship, and also bought enough time for AE-2 to sink and preventing the capture of the vessel. Once his crew were all in the water, Stoker then joined them. The entire crew of AE-2 survived her sinking and were picked up by Turkish forces, becoming prisoners of war as they boarded a rescue boat sent by the captain of the Sultan Hassar, Ali Reza Bey. After their capture, the crew of AE-2 were held prisoners of war by the Turks. The officers were separated from the men, which was the custom, and Stoker spent the next 3.5 years in various Turkish prisons and internment camps. While at Afyon Karahisar in March 1916, he escaped and was on the run for 18 days before he was recaptured and imprisoned in Constantinople. In February 1917, he was moved to an internment camp at Yozgad, but later returned to Afyon until the war ended in November 1918. Stoker was repatriated to England in December of that year and reverted to Royal Navy service 9th of February 1919 when he was promoted to commander and assigned the 1st to the submarine flotilla leader HMS Ethereal, then to the submarine flotilla leader HMS Inconstant on the 27th of October for, quote, submarine K9 in command, unquote. When he returned to England, he penned a report on the treatment he received as a prisoner of war of the Ottoman Empire. A portion of the report stated that, quote, the prison contained civilian prisoners under the sentence for all types of crimes. It was filthy and filled with many kinds of vermin, but chiefly with bugs of which they were legion. These loathsome creatures made sleep impossible at night. In order to get a place in the WC, I had to wait amongst a crowd of ordinary criminals, generally fighting for my place at the end. In order to force information of military value from me, I was subjected to all sorts of threats and offers of humiliating nature, separated from my brother officers. Placed in a room of approximately 20 foot by 8 foot with 4 Turks, and finally placed in solitary confinement, unquote. On his return to England, he was also reunited with his wife Olive, though this would not be a blissful reunion, as he would discover that in his absence she had birthed 3 children to other men, and the marriage was dissolved. On the 22nd of April 1919, Commander Henry Hugh Gordon Dacre Stoker was awarded the Distinguished Service Order. The citation read, quote, in recognition of his gallantry in making the passage of the Dardanelles in command of His Majesty's Australian submarine, AE-2, on the 25th of April, 1915, unquote. He would then go on to receive a mention in dispatches on the 17th of October that year. Quote, the following officers and men have been brought to the notice of the Admiralty for valuable service in the prosecution of the war. Lieutenant Commander Henry Hugh Gordon Dacre Stoker, DSO, Royal Navy, unquote. By his own words, he'd been in the silent service since 1906, and now had grown tired of it. so he requested a surface vessel command. Unfortunately, due to the state of the post-war Royal Navy, all that could be offered to him was command of HMS Royal Arthur, a seagoing depot ship of the Atlantic Submarine Flotilla. Instead, on the 2nd of October 1920, now disillusioned with a naval career, Stoker chose to leave the Navy and was placed on the retired list. During his time in captivity, he developed an interest in the performing arts, and, at the age of 35, took up a career in acting, operating under the stage name Hugh Gordon. During the interwar period, he established a reputation as a stage actor while also working as a theatre manager. He achieved an intermediate level of success playing Dr. Watson in a series of plays based on Sherlock Holmes stories, and also appeared in productions of R.C. Sheriff's drama on trench warfare, Journey's End. During the interwar period, he dabbled in his other passion, which was sport and in particular tennis, where he competed under the name Hugh Stoker and entered into the Wimbledon Championships from 1920 to 1927. In 1920, he lost in the first round. The following year, he reached the third round. In 1922, 23, and 24, he was eliminated in the second round. In 1925, in his last foray in 1927, he was eliminated in the first rounds of competition. In 1925, he wrote Straws in the Wind, an account of his wartime experiences, and that very year he married Dorothy Margaret Pidcock, who was a fellow actor. In 1932, he co-wrote a play, Below the Surface, with J.L. Hunt, who had also served in submarines, and it had a successful run in London. He went on to film acting in 1933, appearing in Channel Crossing. During his acting career, he appeared in seven films, including Brighton Rock in 1947 with Richard Attenborough. By the late 1930s, he had a busy theatre career managing the Apollo Theatre in London, while also directing and acting. His filmography lists at least 44 times as an actor on the silver screen, twice as a writer and once as an editor, though it should be noted that most of his roles were uncredited. At the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939, Stoker rejoined the Navy and was initially appointed as Chief of Staff to Rear Admiral Matthew King, commander of the Belfast-based HMS Caroline. Stoker was then appointed to command the shore installation at Lowestoft, HMS Minos, which was subjected to German air raids almost on a daily basis for 2 years. Exhausted, he transferred to a public relations appointment with the Admiralty Press Division, and in April 1944, he served on the naval planning staff for the D-Day landings, where he served until the end of the war. In 1946, he reverted to the retired list at the rank of captain. After the war, he returned to the theatre and continued to write. With K.B. Woolard, he co-wrote a play entitled Morning Departure, but had a falling out with Woolard and refused to be cited in the play's credits. In 1950, the play was made into a successful film starring John Mills. Stoker continued to work in theatre, films and television until he retired in the 1950s. After retiring from the stage, he became the president of the Royal Navy Lawn Tennis Association from 1953 to 1963. In 1962, he also became the Irish croquet champion at the age of 77. Captain Henry Hugh Gordon Dacre Stoker, Distinguished Service Order, mentioned in dispatches, died at the St. Stephen's Hospital in Chelsea, London on the 2nd of February 1966, the day of his 81st birthday. He was survived by his second wife, Dorothy. Unlike her sister, AE2 did not generate the same interest in finding what happened to her, namely because no one had died aboard her, and her actions on the 25th of April 1915 were largely forgotten by the Australian public. Well, that didn't mean that no one was looking for her. In 1995, the Turkish maritime historian Selçuk Kolay of the Ramiş Koç Museum in Istanbul began a series of underwater searches for the missing boat. In 1996, he discovered what he thought was the wreck lying in 86 meters or 282 feet of water. With the assistance of an Australian diving team, it was determined in October 1997 that the wreck was actually of an old steamer. After a further thorough side-scan sonar and magnetometric survey of the reported scuttling site of AE2, Kolay located the submarine in June 1998, lying in 72 metres or 236 feet of water. The wreck was first dived on in July, with subsequent dives by an Australian team in October, which were able to confirm the wreck as being AE2. To this day, the Australian government has made no claim to the shipwreck, and the submarine is not listed as a war grave. On the 9th of December 2007, Australian and Turkish naval authorities began an undersea investigation to determine if AE2 could be raised and restored. Such a plan would see the submarine transferred to a viewing tank in Çanakkale, and as part of the inspection, a drop camera was inserted through the submarine's open hatch and into the control room. The survey team discovered that the wreck of AE2 had suffered further damage since the original 1998 inspection dives. The bow portion of the external hull casing has been destroyed, and the rear of the conning tower now showed significant damage. Following a workshop in April 2008 by the Turkish Institute of Nautical Archaeology and the Submarine Institute of Australia, the recommendation was made against raising the wreck. Moving the submarine to a viewing tank or, alternatively, relocating the wreck to shallow water was advised against because the costs associated with were between $80 and $100 million. Moving AE-2 would also pose a high risk to both the submarine and any vessels involved in its relocation, as there was still an unexploded torpedo aboard. Instead, the workshop advised that the submarine be preserved in situ, along with buoys and surveillance systems to mark the wreck and to detect any unauthorized access and potential damage. In June 2014, a remotely operated vehicle commanded by Defense Science and Technology Organization did several dives on the wreck, and several significant discoveries were made, including the confirmation of the existence of the portable wireless telegraph pole and antenna wire. During the exploration, sacrificial anodes were fitted to the wreck and the location was marked with a buoy to minimize damage by passing vessels. In 2011, it was announced that Stoker's actions on the 25th of April 1915 would be included into the inquiry into unresolved recognition for past acts of naval and military gallantry and valor, known colloquially as the Valor Inquiry. This inquiry was conveyed following a question raised in the Australian Senate in 2010 asking why no member of the Royal Australian Navy had received the Victoria Cross, and including 13 men, most of whom were from the Navy. Now, I've already covered three of these men, Captain Hector MacDonald Laws Waller, leading air craftsman Noel Shipp, and midshipman Robert Ian Davies, and I will be working my way through the rest of the list. Unlike the other men that I've already covered, like Waller and Davies, Stoker had his entire crew as witness for his actions, many of whom kept diaries even during their captivity, as well as records from Turkish authorities to support the claim. Arguments made in favour of Stoker receiving the Victoria Cross are convincing. Four other submarines that forced the Dardanelles, their commanding officers, all received the decoration. Not only Holbrook, but Commander Boyle of E-14, Lieutenant Commander Eric Martin Dunbar-Smith of E-11, and Lieutenant Commander Jeffrey Saxton White, who also commanded E-14. The argument made that Stoker was the first, proving the others that it was possible, but only received a second-tiered award in the Distinguished Service Order. The argument was also made that because AE-2's operation within the Dardanelles went for a week and was directly mentioned in official reports pertaining to the Gallipoli landings, and was constantly attacked by shore batteries and Turkish warships, meant that he was entitled to a bravery award along with his leadership award, the DSO. However, not all these arguments held the same weight, with some claiming that simply because AE-2 was, quote, a colonial vessel, unquote, it was overlooked, and even some took the extreme claim that because Stoker was Irish, that was the reason why he was overlooked. Now, normally, I only offer my uneducated counsel on the findings after the evidence for both sides have been given, but in this instance, I do side with the decision of the tribunal to not award Stoker a VC. The arguments against the award are as straightforward as the reasons for Davies. The most glaring of this is Stoker wasn't even Australian. He was a Royal Navy officer on loan to the Royal Australian Navy, and as the Imperial Victoria Cross is no longer available to Australia since the establishment of the Australian System of Awards in 1975, and the phasing out of Australian eligibility of British or Imperial awards as of 1994, it would have been improper to award a deceased Royal Navy officer the Victoria Cross for Australia. If anything, the Royal Navy would have to raise the issue with the monarch to have him recognised. Furthermore, he was proud of his DSO and never sought further recognition. And at the time, the only accounts of the actions undertaken by AE-2 were submitted by Stoker himself. And historically, the recipient cannot nominate themselves for a higher award. And yes, while four other submarine commanders did receive the Victoria Cross, all of them were able to bring their boats home afterwards. To date, no officer has received the highest award for gallantry for surrendering their vessel, no matter how cold that may sound. At the time, the Australian Naval Board was well aware of Stoker's actions. He had written to them while in captivity, and they thanked him for having achieved for the Australian service the honour of an Australian submarine being the first to pass the Dardanelles into the Sea of Marmara, but they didn't approach the Admiralty to upgrade his DSO to a VC. As the Valor Inquiry was being convened in March 2010, the Royal Australian Navy also overhauled its battle honour system, something that I alluded to in my Noel Shipp episode. As a result of this, AE-2 was also retroactively awarded the honours Rabaul 1914 and Dardanelles 1915. Like his brother officer, Stoker's legacy continues to this day, when, on the 21st of May 2015, MV Stoker, a submarine rescue gear ship, was launched alongside her sister, the MV Besant. Both were able to deploy rescue submersibles with decompression chambers and medical facilities to help respond and rescue submarines trapped below the surface. The loss of AE-1 and AE-2 had a lasting legacy in the Royal Australian Navy, with AE-1 being the first Australian warship lost and AE-2 being the first lost in combat. In 1919, the Royal Navy lent 6 J-class boats to Australia, and some of these were actually crewed by members of AE2. These boats were beset with issues, with all being escorted by the returning HMAS Australia, and were plagued by the same mechanical issues AE1 and AE2 had on their first journey to Australia. When they arrived, things only really got worse for them, under the command of Commander Boyle, VC. While they proved useful in war games and even succeeded in sinking both HMAS Australia and Sydney in mock attacks, they also really sank a New Zealand schooner and a French sailing vessel. By 1920, serious questions were being raised as to the feasibility of maintaining the submarine fleet, and in 1921, half of the fleet was put in reserve, and those that remained in service continued their spate of bad luck. With one boat hauling the HMS Huon after a collision, then issues resulting in a successive slashing of defence budgets meant that the boats could no longer be crewed, which resulted in all of the J-class boats of the Royal Australian Navy being sunk either as breakwaters or as gunfire targets by the end of 1926. Fascinatingly though, their service didn't end there. In 2007, in preparation for the dives on AE2, Australian dive teams conducted several dives on the J-class wrecks in Australian waters, as they were, at the time, the only First World War sub-wrecks that were easily accessible. Captain Henry Stoker and AE2 are truly the silent Anzac. The moniker highlights the lesser-known yet important role played by her during the Gallipoli campaign. The passage of AE2 through the Dardanelles was not only an exceptional feat of submarine navigation for a man who got third-class passes in navigation, but also served as a symbol of Australia's early foray into submarine warfare. It demonstrated the potential of submarines to disrupt enemy operations, providing a template for future naval strategies, and showcased the courage and resourcefulness of submariners. So to Stoker and the Silent Anzac, we see you and your service, and for that, we are eternally grateful. Articles cited in this episode are A Century of Silent Service by Graham Seal, Australian Submarines Volume 2 by Michael White, the Trove Newspaper Archive of the National Library of Australia, the Australian National Submarine Museum, the website Australian E-Class Submarines, the service record of Lieutenant Commander Henry Gordon Dacre Stoker at the National Archives of Australia and of the United Kingdom, the History of Submarines from Silence and Stealth from The Collector, World War I British Submarines from the Naval Encyclopedia, British Submarines in World War I from the History Learning Centre, AE2 in World War I by the Gunplot website, the official website of the Bram Stoker Estate, Men of Silent Anzac from the National Maritime Museum of Australia, the website Takiri Shipwrecks, Lieutenant Commander Henry Stoker, An Historic Journey, the AE2 and the Gallipoli Campaign, and At Sea by the Anzac Day Commemoration Committee, the IMDb entry on H.D. Stoker, the Royal Australian Navy website articles on Lieutenant Commander Henry Hugh Gordon Dacre Stoker, HMAS AE2 and MV Stoker, the Parliamentary Secretary for Defence Victoria Cross Inquiry press release by the Parliament of Australia, the submarine AE2 in World War I by the Naval Historical Society of Australia, HMAE Submarine AE2 by the Submarine Institute, the Dictionary of Irish Biography entry on Henry Hugh Gordon Dacre Stoker, HMA Submarine AE2 in the Dardanelles from the Australian Department of Veterans Affairs, the Victoria Cross and George Cross Association, the report of the inquiry into unresolved recognition for past acts of military... No. The report of the inquiry into unresolved recognition for past acts of naval and military gallantry and valour 2011, Issue 113 of Signals released by the Australian National Maritime Museum, Henry Stoker, Sailor, Sportsman, Actor, Hero by Jasper Coping via The Telegraph, Volume 1, The Story of Anzac from the Outbreak of the War to the End of the First Phase of the Gallipoli Campaign, March 4, 1915, of the Official History of Australia in the War 1914-1918, and the website of the Australian War Memorial. In particular, the entries on HMAS AE2, the Australian Submarine, AE2 by Ian Hodges, HMAS AE1 and HMAS AE2, Australia's First Submarines, and Dawn of the Legend, 25th of April 1915, Australian Submarine AE2. Now that's a lot of references. Some of those sources are only available thanks to the ongoing support and contributions from the Armoured Emu Brigade community. And if you want to join in on the conversation or even join the brigade, you can do so over on our social media channels. At this point, the podcast is on everything, but the core home of the Armoured Emu Brigade is our Discord server. The links to everything are on our website as well as in the episode description. If you want to support the podcast, you now have two options. You can either buy the podcast a one-off coffee or join us on Patreon for ongoing support. Each cent given goes directly into the digitization of records, as well as the distribution and licensing, as well as sourcing those hard-to-come-by publications. Once again, the United States is still leading the rankings for most listened country, now by a quite considerable margin, with Ashburn, Virginia still the highest-ranked city, which is surprising considering as I don't know anyone who is in Ashburn. So if you are listening, reach out to us. Now, thank you all so much for your continued support over the last couple of episodes, but this is the end of History Talks Shipwreck Summer. Now, while I've been recording the last two episodes, I've also been collaborating with friend of the podcast, Melissa Ratliff of God's Favourites History Podcast, and that episode will be next. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. But if you enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the Shipwreck series, please leave a review or share it with a friend, as it's the best way to get the show in the ears of people who you think need to hear it. Before I go, I want to thank my colleague Claire Taylor, who helped me with the Turkish pronunciations used throughout this episode. If it wasn't for her, there was no way this was going to sound anywhere near as credible. And for that, thank you and good luck with your future endeavors. Until next time, friends, catch you around. Bye. Thanks for listening to the I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History Podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Gangdangara people, whose elders have passed on knowledge for thousands of years, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This episode was written, researched, produced, directed, and audio engineered by me, Ross, with additional research done by Laurie Favell of My Silent Hero. If you do know someone whose story needs to be told, feel free to leave a comment on an episode or send us an email at iwasonlydoingmyjobpod@gmail.com. If you like what we do here and you want to support this podcast, the best thing you can do is share this with a friend or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform, as it really helps others find the show. And if you want to join in on the conversation, join us over on Discord. And if you want more content, including show notes, photos, transcripts, and my various adventures finding memorials dotted around Australia, head over to our website at www.thedocnetwork.net and follow the show on all our social media pages at IWODMJ. Don't worry, there are links to everything in the show notes. Join me personally for more bite-sized history over on TikTok and pretty much everywhere else at Doc Winters. All opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the speaker and don't reflect the views or opinions of any entity, agency, or organization. It is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time. Bye.